This is the eHealth Radio Network, your source for health advice on demand. And now your host, Eric Michaels.
Once again, thanks for joining us here on the eHealth Radio Network. This is your host, Eric Michaels. eHealth Radio gives you the most current health information, news, and advice featuring some of the leading innovators in healthcare and wellness who are changing healthcare as we know it. For more eHealth Radio reports, we invite you to visit our main radio channel site at eHealthRadioNetwork.com. Today on the show is Dr. Laura Goitein, an MD and Harvard-trained physician specializing in intensive care and lung medicine. She founded a clinician-directed quality improvement program at a Santa Fe, New Mexico hospital and is president-elect of the medical staff. Her professional interests include quality improvement in healthcare, end-of-life care, the training of new doctors, physician burnout, and improving communication with patients and families. Her new book is The ICU Guide for Families Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. And such a pleasure to have you with us today, Dr. Goitein, on the program.
Thanks so much for having me, Eric. It's a real pleasure.
The pleasure is all ours, Dr. Goitein, and thanks for your time. So you worked as an ICU doctor for 12 years in several different hospitals, but in the past several years, you've transitioned to practicing mostly in your other area of expertise as a specialist in lung diseases, as well as in a hospital quality improvement care there. Do you miss practicing ICU medicine is the first question, and did you like it when you were doing that?
I do miss practicing ICU medicine. The word like is a little bit simplistic for a profession in which so many of your patients are seriously ill or even pass away. But what I liked about it was that you play a very central, important role in the most pivotal moments of patients' lives. And even though you may not get to meet them when they're conscious and speaking, you get to know them through their families extremely well. You get to know what's most important to them. How do they feel about how to live and how to die? Do they believe in God? What are they scared of? You, of course, get to know them physiologically very well. And you have very profound relationships with their families. All of the surface talk and the trivial aspects seem to really fall away, and you're just left with the heart of really what matters. And I loved that part of ICU medicine. It was extremely intense, but also extremely rewarding.
It does make sense, and I could see both perspectives there on the intensity as well as the rewards being involved in ICU medicine. Now, tell us, why did you actually write this book, The ICU Guide for Families?
You know, I've been meaning to write this book for 15 years, and I had a sort of a transition in my work corresponding with my kids being home during COVID, and that provided the perfect opportunity to finally get it done. So I have always felt a really profound sympathy for the family members of ICU patients. In some ways, I think they suffer more than the patients, who are often not fully conscious or perhaps sedated. But the families are, you know, first terrified for their loved one. But they're also immersed in a very alien, intimidating world. Most of us, unless we work in the ICU, find that world very intimidating and confusing. There's new equipment, lots of people of uncertain roles, lots of medical conditions and foreign terminology, and a lot of families are desperately in need of explanations. Physicians and nurses in the ICU are extremely busy. They recognize the importance of talking to families and giving them the explanations they need, but they often just practically can't take the time that they would like to do so. And I realize that over time I've accumulated a number of explanations that I've given over and over and over again, and this book is really a compilation of those explanations so that family members who paradoxically may have a lot of downtime waiting in waiting rooms or sometimes at the bedside can read. The other thing I thought was so important was that family members often feel very powerless and helpless, very peripheral to what's going on and sort of pushed to the side. That should not be the case. Families have a very central role to play as advocates for their loved ones, but they need a little guidance to understand how to do that, and I hope that this book provides that guidance.
Well, let me say we're appreciative of your taking the time and the effort to write this book, a big need, I think, and especially with COVID-19 going on, there's so much need and support there, so I'm sure this is a must-read at any point in time. Now, what are examples of some of the practical ways people can help their loved ones when they are admitted to the ICU?
Families know their loved ones better than anyone else, and they certainly have access to certain kinds of information that caregivers might not have. So they know the full medical history, they know the signs and symptoms that preceded the illness, they know the behaviors that might have had an impact on the illness, and they clearly know the values of the patients that might inform very important decisions. So the first way is just to be a conveyor of that information to your medical team as it's needed. There are also very practical ways that families can contribute to day-to-day care. They are often asked to give consent for procedures. Having a full understanding of how to do that well is very important and can be a real contributor to making good decisions for the patient. There are also day-to-day housekeeping measures that need to happen in ICUs to help prevent the complications of ICU care. So some of those complications are things like healthcare-associated infections. You know, every piece of plastic that an ICU patient has in their body, like large IVs or breathing tubes for the ventilator, can serve as a possible conduit for infection. Most ICU doctors are very aware of this and are very careful to get rid of those pieces of plastic as soon as they possibly can. But family members can help with that and talk to their nurses every day about whether the patient might be ready to have a piece of plastic removed. They can also help with other aspects like helping to keep a patient calm and oriented and helping busy nurses with things like mobilizing patients, getting them moving, getting them up to a chair. These things are very important for avoiding the complications of ICU admissions, and families can really play an active role in that. In my book, each section is followed with a text box with some very practical suggestions for how patients' family members can help contribute on a day-to-day basis in supporting the ICU team giving the best possible care.
Dr. Goitein, really do appreciate the time taken to be with us here today. Some good information and most intriguing and helpful as well today. We're speaking with Dr. Laura Goitein, an MD and a Harvard-trained physician specializing in intensive care and lung medicine. Her new book, as we have mentioned, is The ICU Guide for Families, Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. And she's joined us here today on eHealth Radio's Health Care and Health News channels, a part of the eHealth Radio network. Now, Dr. Goitein, are there commonalities in the way family members cope with the stress of an ICU admission for a loved one?
Yeah, I mean, everyone has a different method of coping with the intense stress of an ICU admission. So, you know, in some ways, everyone is unique. But there are certain commonalities that you see over and over again in the way, in the coping mechanisms people use. And it's helpful, I think, sometimes to understand those so that you can recognize them and maybe avoid some of the potential downfalls of those mechanisms. So one very typical way of coping that we often see is what I call the learners. These are people who want to know and understand every detail. They spend a lot of time doing research, being on the internet, asking questions of their doctor friends. They often keep notebooks and bring in articles. They watch the monitors and the alarms very carefully and try to understand everything that they can. And I have a huge sympathy for this very smart way of coping. It's the way I myself tend to try to cope with stress, to learn everything I can about it. And it's a very functional mechanism. The downsides are that you can really exhaust yourself. And also, it's very easy to get lost to lose the forest for the trees when you're diving into that much detail and maybe put undue energy and emphasis on areas that might mislead you. So at some point, I would suggest to those people that they trust in their physicians and not exhaust themselves completely. That's one example of a very typical coping mechanism. On the other side, there are people who really prefer not to get into the weeds. They would like to trust their caregivers completely and sometimes give them almost a reverential treatment and prefer to really avoid the details. This is also a perfectly acceptable way of coping. The downside is that sometimes they lose the opportunity to be as informed advocates as they can be. These two groups of people sometimes really irritate each other. The people who want to trust in the healthcare team and avoid the details see the learners as a sort of aggressive and inappropriately overstepping, and the learners can't understand what they see as basically avoidance in their family members. So understanding that these are very common natural reactions, I think, is important to getting along with the rest of the family in the ICU waiting room.
Also, Dr. Goitein, as you point out, family members are often desperate for information about their loved one's condition, but they sometimes find it difficult to know when and how to communicate with the doctors in the ICU. Do you have any advice in this regard?
Yes. Communication is really a challenge for family members in the ICU, and this is particularly true now, of course, during the pandemic, when visitation is often restricted and healthcare workers are obviously just overwhelmed. Even in the best of times, health care workers in the ICU range from busy to frantically busy, really. And their workload is very variable. It depends on how many patients arrive that day and how sick they are and what crises and urgent situations arise. So it's very hard for them to commit to appointments for discussions, for example. It can help to know the schedule, which varies from ICU to ICU. In general, in the morning, physicians, I'm speaking now about speaking with physicians in particular, physicians tend to be pretty busy in the morning catching up with what happened overnight, pre-rounding on all of their patients, getting caught up on all of the information from the night and the day before. And then they'll be leading interdisciplinary ICU rounds, in most cases, sometime in the morning. These ICU rounds are when the whole ICU team travels around from room to room and discusses the patient, the recent events, and the plan for that day. This is a great time for families to hear that information. It's usually possible outside of the pandemic situation, of course, for families to stand and listen to those ICU rounds. It's not a great time for discussion and questions. It's very business-like and definitely oriented to getting work done. Generally, the best time to speak with your physicians will be in the afternoons and evenings after all the fires are put out and a lot of the work has been initiated for all of the patients. What I would really suggest is giving physicians some flexibility and control over the time that you meet with them. So, for example, rather than saying, could you meet with me at 3 p.m.? You could say, I understand that you're more available in the afternoons. I will plan to be present and available between 2 p.m. and 5 p.m. If you have time in that range to come drop by and talk to me, I'd really appreciate it. That is something that leaves then the flexibility and the control to meet with you. So that would be what I would suggest. I think that it's important for family members to understand that your doctors want to talk to you. They understand the importance of that and getting your input and making sure that you understand what's going on. And you have a right to expect that. So in general, I would say if a patient is, you know, very unstable, has just arrived, things are moving quickly, you know, you can expect an update from the physician maybe every few hours at least. In situations where the patient has really stabilized, maybe been there for several days, you know, you should expect to be able to have an update perhaps once a day. So it is important to recognize that you have a right to have those conversations, but it's also important to recognize how very difficult it is for your physicians to plan times to speak with you with any certainty. So being as flexible and available as possible is definitely helpful.
Tremendous advice in those regards. Thank you so much. Now, you mentioned COVID, and how can we even avoid bringing that up during this session today? But how is ICU medicine during the COVID-19 pandemic different?
Well, there are the obvious differences in the limitations of visitation and other infection control issues. And this has caused some very tragic situations where families are separated when their loved ones are extremely ill and even dying. And that's a terrible thing and a profound difference that is affecting, patients and their families, obviously, and also healthcare staff. These restrictions are loosening a little bit. I think people are starting to recognize that what we gained from infectious control was maybe more than offset by the problems that it posed. So these restrictions are loosening but remain a major barrier for patients and their families during COVID. COVID is very unique in its contagiousness and in the fact that it's a global pandemic. Omicron in particular is extremely infectious and just surging dramatically. That being said, the actual critical care medicine for COVID-19 is quite similar to that for other conditions. So, for example, COVID-19 causes something called ARDS, which is acute respiratory distress syndrome, and that's basically a severe inflammatory injury to the lungs. ARDS is also caused by many other illnesses in the ICU. And in the beginning of the pandemic, when we really just didn't have much information, there was a lot of speculation about all the ways in which ARDS in COVID was different and should be treated differently. But more and more, we have learned that the ARDS in COVID behaves very similarly to the ARDS from other causes. And similarly, some of the other organ complications of COVID are things that we see in other contexts in the ICU all the time. So what has turned out to be the case, although there are some COVID-specific therapies, what has turned out to be the case is that much of ICU care is the same. And what's really important is in the setting of an overwhelmed healthcare system and all of the infection prevention issues, trying to adhere to the same standards of excellent, meticulous ICU care that we do for all other conditions.
Yeah, we're certainly living in different times today. Obviously, within healthcare, it is a big, big changer. And I really do appreciate all the information pointed out in that regard. Now, family members, as we conclude, family members are sometimes asked to make very tough decisions on behalf of patients who are not awake or otherwise able to make decisions on their own behalf. This includes decisions about withholding or withdrawing of life support. Major decisions. In your book, you offer some suggestions for how to approach these decisions. Could you talk about that as we conclude today?
Yes. So many family members, as more and more time passes with their loved one in the ICU, they start to begin to worry that a prolonged ICU stay would not be in accordance with their loved one's wishes. We can now keep almost anyone technically alive. We have medications and devices to support blood pressure, machines to do the work of kidneys, the ventilator, breathing machine. So we can really sustain, you know, what is technically life in most cases, far beyond what would leave someone with a reasonable quality of life after they potentially left the ICU. So that's something that really no one wants. A lot of family members, when they first start to think, okay, when is enough and enough, feel very guilty and almost monstrous. But these decisions on behalf of loved ones are very common. 65% of the deaths in ICU happen because a decision has been made to withdraw life-supporting care. So it's the minority of cases where patients die while we're still trying everything we can, despite all the machines and medications, et cetera. Usually, it's been a decision made with the interests of the patient in mind to withdraw life-supporting treatment. So this is extremely common and not monstrous. It's actually loving and necessary. At some point, the question becomes not whether someone will die, but how they will die. And that falls to families often. So I think it can help families who, you know, sometimes feel this is a terrible responsibility to realize that their job is really not to say what they think is best. Their job is to represent that patient's wishes, knowing everything that they know about the patient. Of course, if there's an advanced directive, providing some guidance, that helps a lot. But in the absence of that, there are usually conversations in the past, and understanding of that patient's values that when you put it together with the medical picture can help you to make a decision that you feel would be most in alignment with that person's wishes. Sometimes that may be very different from yours. You may feel in your heart that a patient would be ready to let go, and you might not want to let them go. So sometimes these decisions require a lot of courage and selflessness. But I also think it does help to take off that feeling of responsibility, to realize that you are representing what they would want, not what you would want. I think a lot of people are pressured by what I call the tyranny of hope. They will hold out for very small hopes that a person will recover. And in some cases, that's entirely appropriate. Just as an example, say you have a young woman who has several children, maybe one with special needs, and she might very well want to fight no matter what the odds, and that might be entirely appropriate. There are other people for whom it would be more appropriate to think about what is most likely to happen to this person. So, even if, say, you have a very elderly person with prolonged mechanical ventilation, meaning they are on a ventilator for more than, say, 2 weeks, you know, that person still may have a decent chance of survival, but may have a very compromised quality of life afterwards in which they're highly dependent. And that would not be the case for all such patients, but it's the most likely scenario. And for some patients, it makes more sense to think about the most likely scenario and whether that scenario would be what the person would want. So I think thinking of those two approaches quite concretely, one being the small hopes approach and one being the most likely approach, can help a family to be clearer in their thinking about these very difficult issues.
Dr. Goitien, I know you've seen a lot in your time, and we can't thank you enough for sharing some valuable information here today about ICU experiences and decisions to be made. And thank you so much for what you do in the space. Where can listeners pick up your book, The ICU Guide for Families, as well as to be in touch with you in some fashion, form or fashion?
So the book is available through many sellers, including Amazon. It's also available from my publisher's site, which is Roman and Littlefield. They can also go to my website, which is medicalexplainer.com, and there's a link to purchase the book there.
That sounds easy enough. Again, that is medicalexplainer.com. Dr. Goitien, all the best. Thanks so much for joining us here today on eHealth Radio. Certainly was our pleasure.
Thank you so much. It was a real pleasure.
Again, we've been speaking with Dr. Laura Goitien, an MD, a Harvard-trained physician specializing in intensive care and lung medicine. Her new book is The ICU Guide for Families Understanding Intensive Care and How You Can Support Your Loved One. And for all the details, visit medicalexplainer.com. And again, this has been your host, Eric Michaels, and we do thank you for your continued support of the eHealth Radio Network. Join us again soon for another episode that will help further expand your knowledge on those things that are important to your health and wellness. For more eHealth Radio reports, we invite you to visit our main radio channel site at eHealthRadioNetwork.com. And as always, we do thank you for tuning in.
Thanks for tuning in to the eHealth Radio Network. For more information or to subscribe to this podcast, visit eHealthRadioNetwork.com.